my opinion and the opinion, I think, of a number of other judges around the state, that there is a much more simple way to approach the problem if, in fact, this is the direction that the legislature wants to go. One of the main problems from the judiciary point of view, setting aside any constitutional questions that are involved here, is that I believe most judges do not agree that this bill produces truth in sentencing, if that's going to be the catchword here. What it does is it simply shifts the falsity in sentencing to the trial judge level and will require the trial judge to give a sentence to an individual which in most or many cases would not be the sentence that that trial judge would choose to impose had he or she anything to say about it. It will continue the myth that people are being sentenced by their elected officials in a fashion that they think is appropriate, when in truth and in fact what is happening is those people will be sentenced in accordance with a matrix that is imposed upon them and that they are required to follow, and that to date has had nothing to do with what the judges think are the appropriate sentences to be imposed, and there's no reason to believe that that would change under the bill as proposed in 2087. As I've indicated, I think there are tremendous problems. One example is starting a pre-sentence report on everyone when they come into the system. The costs and the time and the effort involved in that seem to me to be pretty disproportionate to the result that you get. I can only speak for Lane County. I'm sure, though, however, that in Multnomah County and other counties around the state, there are oftentimes charges that are filed that end up being dismissed. Defendants who are charged with felonies who plead to misdemeanors, all kinds of combinations that may result in the pre-sentence report never being needed or not being a viable option for sentencing necessarily. And further, I think you get into some very interesting questions in regard to requiring a person charged with a crime, as opposed to being convicted of one, to go to the corrections division, produce information for them, when as yet they're still presumed to be innocent of the charge filed against them. They have not proceeded to trial. No determination has been made. There are, I think, numerous things of that nature in the bill, but I think more importantly what I'd like to suggest to the committee is that one does not have to go through all the things that are involved in House Bill 2087 to produce essentially the same effect, and in my opinion a better effect, if what you're trying to do is to continue the leveling process of the parole board. If you are trying to produce some honesty in the sentencing process so that the public and those who are involved in the judicial process are not misled and clearly perceive who's in charge when it comes down to who's going to stay in prison how long, then the simplest approach that I know of is one that I proposed last term and I'm here to propose again to this committee, is to simply not have the judge make a decision on an upper limit of a sentence. Right now, the judge goes into court, has read the pre-sentence report, hears from the parties, makes a decision that this person should be incarcerated, and it's up to us to then set a time for that person to be incarcerated, whether it's 3 years or 5 years or 8 years or whatever it may be. All that produces is having the court cut the top end out of any sentence that might be imposed, because the parole board, in all but a small percentage of cases, is going to have a matrix that is substantially lower than what the trial judge is going to impose. That is caused partially by the way the system operates, in that if you want to have a person serve even the matrix time, you've got to sentence them to somewhere in the neighborhood of 2.5 or 3 times that matrix. So by the time you take into account good time and the matrix time and then the release on parole, that you don't actually give a person too short a time that they're not even going to serve the time the matrix sets. But all of that can be pretty simply avoided if, when the judge sits on the bench and makes the decision that the person is to be incarcerated, the judge simply commits that person to the custody of the corrections division. Upon that, the corrections division has control of that individual up to the maximum sentence that could be imposed, and it is then the job of the parole board to take into account through their matrix and whatever the criteria are that they care to insert into that, how long they're going to keep the person. That way, I and other judges do not sit on the bench and say to an individual who knows it's a lie that they're going to do 3 years or 5 years or 8 years or 20 years, and this fine sentence does not come out in the newspaper and all the people cluck or applaud, whichever they may think appropriate. And what you will see is simply that the defendant was committed to the custody of the corrections division. Seems to me by doing that, you allow the parole board to have the ultimate control over the flow of bodies through the prison system. You don't have to create a new commission. You don't have to create a bunch of new rules. You don't have to try and deal with the constitutional issues that have been raised here. And you don't continue what I see, and I believe many other judges see, as the deception of our actually setting sentences when everyone who is involved with the system knows that we are in fact not doing that, and all we're doing at our sentencing proceedings, once that in custody decision has been made, is all we're scrapping about is whether the defense lawyer can talk you into cutting the top end out of the system. We can avoid all of those things. We can avoid essentially all of the things that are in House Bill 2087 by that simple process, and I would commend that to the committee as an alternative that is much more simple, easy to deal with, because you can deal with it within the system that we now have, and I believe creates really total honesty in the sentencing process. That would be my recommendation. That's why I'm opposed to 2087. I do not offer that suggestion as one that I think is the appropriate way that sentencing ought to occur in the state of Oregon. I still believe, and I've always believed, and I'll continue to believe, that judges ought to sentence, and that ought to be the sentence, and people ought to go do it less any good time. But I don't think that's a political reality at this point, and I don't propose it for that reason. But I think my proposal that I've made here today addresses the problems that you try to address in 2087 and does it much more quickly and easily and cleanly than 2087 will do.
Judge, first a comment. I will understand the sentiment of many judges who prefer to resolve the truth in sentencing problem and perhaps also vest authority for actually determining periods of confinement where they think really appropriate by simply allowing judges, in effect, to determine that period of confinement really without any standards. I think the amount of discretion that that injects into the system and the potential for severely differential treatment of like conduct is the part that troubles me as a policymaker, and I think that's part of the problem with it politically.
Oh, I fully understand that, and that's why I say I feel like that when I come here and make the proposal that I do to you today, I only feel like I have to say, sort of for my own benefit, that I gag a little bit on it because that's not what I think ought to happen. But I also, as I say, think that that is reality. I understand where the system appears to be going. I have no expectation that I or a few others of us are going to turn that around, whether we'd like to or not. And that's why I'm here, just simply to say that's not what my druthers are, but I think what I propose today will meet what your druthers are and where I see the legislature trying to go in solving some of the problems that you have before you.
Let me ask you a question, if I may.
Sure.
What is your view of the context of the proposal you've made? What is your view of the retention or the repeal of the power of the trial judge to specify a minimum period of confinement? Are you proposing that be retained or that it be repealed?
My personal choice is that that be retained. I think that that does then give the judge at least some control when he or she deals with a case, knows intimately the facts that are involved, has dealt face-to-face with the person that's involved in the case, and is able to still look at the known matrix and say, gosh, in my opinion, that's just simply not enough given the kind of case we have here. I think that I'm told anyway that the parole board has been sustaining somewhere around 75% of the mandatory minimums. That may change from time to time. That was the last figure that I had heard from the parole board. I think that has worked reasonably well. The parole board still would have the ability to override that as they have now based upon whatever criteria they might want to adopt. So I would personally prefer that. I think it would be appropriate from my discussion with other judges, and I think Judge Bonebrick can probably speak to that more accurately since he's had an opportunity to poll some of the judges and has more information than I. But my belief is that that would be a component that most judges would want to have remain at their disposal so that they felt like they were retaining at least some control to try and set some bottoms anyway.
I take it from what you're saying that you will also support retention of the parole board's authority to set aside that minimum.
I think given the system as it has now evolved and developed, I think it's unrealistic to set that aside. I say that because it appears to me from 2087 and from what I can gather that one of the main concerns and a legitimate concern is the crowding that's now going on in the penitentiary and OCI, and if you don't retain that, then it certainly seems to me that you have taken away from the parole board one of the faucets by which they let that trickle out the other end. And so I think from a realistic standpoint, yeah, you've probably got to leave that there.
I think another concern I would have in relation to that power not being retained goes back to the point I was noting earlier of attempting to identify and rectify, if I may use that term, situations which on an overall view of the board appear to represent significantly at least disparate dispositional decisions with respect to similar or like cases. I guess we're going to be going into more detail with the board eventually here as to the process by which those decisions dealing with mandatory minimums are set aside, how that occurs. But I have to assume that that is at least an element in their judgment in some cases.
Oh, I'm sure that it is, and that seems to me to be the basic concept of the whole system is the leveling process of which you and I think Mr. Griffin both spoke earlier. And as long as that is the basic assumption that you make, then I don't see how you could very well not leave in the provision for setting aside mandatory minimums. The same argument and the same, I think, position would go for the stacking of sentences or the judge setting consecutive sentences. I also believe that that should remain, but again, realistically, I think that we're probably looking at the parole board continuing to operate in pretty much the same fashion there as they do now as well. Again, because if you're going to have as one of your criteria the space available, you simply have to be able to adapt to that space available. And if you have judges who can manipulate the system to the point where the parole board loses control over a significant number of people, then you've lost that area of control. And so I think that logically follows. Again, those are not consistent with my personal views, but I think it's consistent with the system that I foresee fitting into.
Further questions? Person Spurrier.
Judge, just briefly, I think one of the points that Mr. Griffith raised has to do with a fact-finding process in terms of those factors of aggravation and mitigation. And I guess, as you may know, a conclusion by the task force that that fact-finding role is best performed at the time of sentencing for several reasons, one of which is that certainly the state is represented and the victims have an opportunity to appear if they wish. And certainly the defendant, the person to be sentenced, is represented by counsel at that time, may present witnesses. And I guess the corollary to that is that if the parole board, some months down the line, tries to make some of the key decisions, the opportunity for representation or for a determination on the record suffers because of the lack of proximity in time and the availability of witnesses, facts, both sides being represented, if you will, in an adversarial process. Would the system that you propose permit or allow that kind of fact-finding to take place before the judge to determine what factors of aggravation or mitigation might exist to, and subsequently a report of those recommendations or facts that are found to exist to the parole boards?
Well, excuse me. In short, the answer is no, because what I propose is not changing anything in the system except that one thing. And the problem that I see with making that change, I think there are a number of problems. One, having now in my, I guess, 5+ years on circuit court, and three of those years been one of the judges in charge of arraignments and doing most of the sentencings, what you end up with at that point is a second trial, or you end up with a guilty plea and then you end up with a trial to try all these factual issues that didn't get tried in the case. You are going to extend your time and your burden on the court system, I think, in large measure if you do that. The propensity of lawyers to argue about every phase of that matrix where you're going to have to make factual determinations seems to me to present unlimited possibilities for continued litigation. You will also then, I am sure, generate a whole new area of appeals based upon whether or not there were sufficient facts for the court to find this, that, or the other to feed into that matrix to get the person to a score that represents their sentence. I see that as a real can of worms that I can't imagine there'd be very many judges that would feel like they'd want to get into. The parole board has been operating now, I understand, with their analysts and specialists who go back, they check the material that comes to them in the pre-sentence report, they find errors that have been made that affect the scores, and those adjustments are made as you go along. I'm not sure that anybody is being unfairly treated in the way that it functions now, and I think it's much preferable to opening up a whole new area of litigation at the time of sentencing. I would certainly hope that you would not do that.
Thank you.
Any further? Thank you, Judge. And we appreciate it today the time you've taken past correspondence within the judiciary that you've shared with the committee in terms of thinking out
Thank
your
you.
Views in this area. Judge Bonebrake, it might be appropriate to have you come now if you would. I believe you've been in communication with the judiciary about this issue to some extent.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Al Bonebrake. I'm a circuit court judge, and I am on the legislative committee of the Judicial Conference. I have, as a part of my position on the legislative committee, polled circuit judges as to what they felt should be done, if anything, by this session of the legislature with regard to sentencing of felons. And historically, as you know, at the I'm sure you're all aware, at the circuit judges meeting last fall, the judges by a resolution passed opposed House Bill 2087, well, the document that is now House Bill 2087, almost unanimously. The poll that I ran recently confirmed that result. Of the 59 ballots that I received back from circuit judges, there was not a single judge that rated House Bill 2087 as their first choice. I felt that there might be four possible things that the legislature might or might not do, and I gave them a choice of those four. One was to do nothing at all and leave us with the status quo. Two was Judge Hargreaves' idea of simply having judges basically make the in-out decision and leave it to someone else the actual length of sentences. The third possibility was House Bill 2087, and the fourth was a proposal that Judge Beatty has set forth, which is basically a variation of House Bill 2087. And of the ballots I received back, 30 judges have approved of Judge Hargreaves' idea, 22 so far, 23, I think, including the most recent ballot today, say do nothing. Judge Beatty's proposal has received 7 approving votes, and as I said, House Bill 2087, none. It's interesting, I think, to note that of the judges that approved of Judge Hargreaves' idea, their second choice was do nothing, and that was the most common. The most common second choice was do nothing at all. First choice, Judge Hargreaves. The most common second choice of those who felt Hargreaves' idea was the best idea was to do nothing. Of those judges that approved of, that felt the legislature should do nothing, the most common second choice was Judge Hargreaves' proposal. So there's a fairly strong tie in there, although, as you can see, there are some 84 circuit court judges, 30 approving of Judge Hargreaves' proposal is less than a majority of the sitting circuit court judges, although it is over half of those that responded to the poll. So that's the information I could give you. It seems to me clear that of the judges that responded, the preferences are, if you do anything, if I was to sum it up, if you do anything at all, it ought to be the idea of allowing judges to simply make the in-out decision. I don't think that probably is what judges would prefer. I testified last week, and I think I told you that I think most judges realistically wish that they could sentence and that the system gave some weight really to the judge's sentence. And I'm not talking about minimum sentences and consecutive sentences, because those do have some impact, but the sentence, the ordinary sentence that a judge imposes has very little bearing or impact really at all upon the actual time that a person serves. We realize that and feel, frankly, that there's no solution in the immediate future to that problem. And so I think we've come to the results that I have indicated as far as the poll that has been taken by me.
Judge, what do you think would account for the bearing in mind what Judge Hargreaves' proposal actually involves, as far as it goes, what do you think would account for the number of judges who would prefer to do nothing as opposed to take that step?
There are a lot of comments.
Well, I don't want to burden you at this point. Can you prepare some summary for us that could,
elaborate
on that?
I could. Some further comments about setting forth what the comments of judges were, why they felt that do nothing at all was appropriate. All right? That's really all I had to report to you at the time. The conference position is in opposition to 2087 as to whether or not you do anything. I think I've given you indication of what some judges think, and that was really all I intended to do today. If there are any questions.
Any questions at this point?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Appreciate the information. Steve Capsch.
For the record, I'm Steve Capsch, the Executive Director of the Oregon Prison Overcrowding Project, 8011 Southwest Front in Portland. I prepared some written commentary that I gave the clerk today to pass out to the committee, and in addition to that, I'd like to simply summarize what my project has been doing on the issues that are before the committee today with respect to House Bill 2087. The Oregon Prison Overcrowding Project is a task force project that's chaired by former U.S. Attorney Sidney Lezak. The cover letter, the cover sheet to the written materials that I've handed out today indicate who the task force members are. All of them are Oregon decision makers and criminal justice experts. Our project is funded jointly by the Edna McConnell Clark Foundation and the National Institute of Corrections through May of 1984. The purpose of the Prison Overcrowding Project is to formulate and implement a comprehensive set of policies which are specific to Oregon, relevant to prison overcrowding, which span the entire criminal justice system and will allow us to achieve system ends, whether they be rehabilitative, deterrent, retributive, or incapacitation, while staying within our means. In other words, the project itself is a resource management project, but one supported by a national organization, national resources, and based on a fundamental assumption that the forces which drive up prison population in terms of who goes to prison and how long they stay span the entire criminal justice system but settle in the correctional system. In other words, we're all a part of the problem, including sentencing and some of the issues that are before you today. Finally, the project is committed to the notion that the problems we see settling in the correctional system in terms of prison crowding are so complex that solutions require the best possible information, the concerted application of the best minds and the widest experience, and not the least of all, the cooperation of all involved segments of the criminal justice system. This is the rationale both for the makeup of our policy group and the process we are following in doing our work. In regard to sentencing in particular and House Bill 2087, OPOP has a subcommittee charged with considering sentencing policies that has been working with House Bill 2087 as well as other ideas. Sentencing has been on the agenda of several of our policy group meetings since our formation a year ago. Has been subject to rather intense discussion and debate. No final positions have been formulated within the Prison Overcrowding Project, but straw votes have been taken, and there is, I think, an emerging consensus, or at least a degree of consensus, around some policy directions that might be taken in regard to sentencing. These are more or less guiding principles for our own work on sentencing and the directions that it may take. There are four propositions that are involved here. First is that the structure of sentencing in Oregon as presently constituted is basically sound despite some obvious problems, and it is therefore a structure on which we can build. Secondly, the decision on who goes into prison and the decision how long they stay should probably be divided between the judiciary and the parole board respectively, but simplified and clarified. This would probably take the form of a system where the trial judge in sentencing would simply say to the custody of the corrections division for a period of time as determined by law or something to that effect. And the parole board would then set the length of stay as it currently does. Thirdly, questions of facts, of data on the factors that affect the length of stay, the history risk, the crime severity, and the aggravating and mitigating circumstances should be subject to adversary process, preferably at the trial court level. This is because the interested parties are already there, and because the goal of what we have in mind is to simplify. Creating another adversary hearing at a different level would complicate rather than simplify the system. Fourth, the judicial members of the Advisory Commission on Prison Terms and Parole Standards should prepare a set of guidelines on the indecision. These would be voluntary, perhaps, and subject to test and evaluation over the next biennium to determine whether or not they can work. I think one thing that can't be overemphasized is that many of the members of the Prison Overcrowding Project policy group feel very strongly that the single most important sentencing issue is that of policy in regard to the decision on who goes into prison. This is so basic that the crowding problem can't be adequately addressed until this aspect is thoroughly analyzed and addressed itself. To do that, we need full data on who goes to prison, how they get there, and the like. In summary, the directions that we're taking are that in Oregon, the decision policies in regard to in are at the heart of the sentencing structure issue, particularly from our perspective, which is that of the impact that sentencing has on prison population. That Oregon's current system is sound basis on